on the bench slightly, excited. Oh, he loved Miami Vice. But the early ones, you know. He always said the show went to hell when Crockett married the singer. Said it got hard to believe after that.
She fumbled in her purse and came back with a cigarette. She lit it and exhaled and followed the smoke with her gaze.
He liked those shows because things made sense back then, you know. World made sense. Those were good days, sensible days.
She looked around the empty park.
Not like now.
Rachel was hard-pressed to imagine two decades in her lifetime that made less sense to her than the 70s and the 80s, or two that seemed less stable or compassionate in general. But she didn't think there was much point in mentioning that to Maddie Grayson.
Did he ever want anything? She asked. How do you mean?
Maddie coughed into her fist.
Like to become, I don't know, something?
Rachel regretted her choice of words as soon as they left her mouth.
Mean like a doctor?
Maddie's eyes grew hard, fast. She looked angry and confused, and angry about the confusion.
Well, I mean...
Rachel stuttered and tried for a friendly smile. Something besides a bartender.
What's wrong with being a bartender?
Maddie tossed her cigarette to the pavement in front of her and turned her knees toward Rachel. She matched Rachel's desperate smile with an iron one.
No, I'm asking. For more than 20 years, people went to Milo's because they knew Lee was behind the bar. They could tell him anything and he wouldn't judge. They could come to him when their marriages went tits up, they lost their jobs, their kids turned into assholes or druggies, fucking world went to shit all around them. But they could sit in front of Lee, and he'd serve them a drink and hear them when they talked.
Rachel said, "Sounds like an amazing guy." Maddie pursed her lips and reared back as if she'd seen a cockroach climb out of her pasta bowl.
He wasn't an amazing guy. He was an asshole a lot of days. I couldn't live with him in the end. But he was a great bartender, and a lot of people were better off for knowing him.
I didn't mean to suggest otherwise.
But you did.
I'm sorry. Maddie pushed a breath through her lips that managed to be both derisive and melancholy at the same time.
The only people who ask questions like, did he want to be something besides a bartender, are people who can become whatever they want. The rest of us are just Americans.
The rest of us are just Americans. Rachel recognized the grubby self-aggrandizement of the line, as well as the faux modesty. She could already hear herself quoting it at cocktail parties, could hear, too, the laughs it would garner. But even as she heard the laughs, they shamed her. She was guilty, after all, of success, a success that stemmed from birthright and privilege. She took hope for granted, saw opportunity as her due, and had never really had to worry about vanishing into a sea of unseen faces and unseen voices. But that was the country her father had inhabited, the country of the unseen and the unheard, and upon their deaths, the unremembered.
I'm sorry if I offended you, she said to Maddie.
Maddie waved it off with a freshly lit cigarette.
Honey, your shit don't mean shit to me.
She gave Rachel's knee a friendly squeeze.
If Lee was your flesh and blood, then good. I hope it brings you peace. Would have been nice for you, I guess, if you'd known him.
She tapped the ash of her cigarette.
But we don't get what we want, just what we can handle.
She visited his grave. It was marked by a common granite headstone, black sprinkled with specks of white. She'd seen the same granite in the kitchen countertops of at least two colleagues. They'd used a lot less granite on Lee Grayson, though. It was a small stone, no more than a foot and a half tall and 20 inches wide. Maddie had told her Lee had purchased it on layaway around the time his own folks passed away, paid it off about 3 years before he died. Leland D. Grayson, November 20th, 1950, December 9th, 2004. There had to be more to it. There had to be. But if there was, she couldn't find it. She'd cobbled together the thumbnail of a biography from what Milo had said about him, what Maddie had said about him, and stray bits both had recalled others had said about him. Leland David Grayson had been born and raised in Elkton, Maryland. He'd passed through a kindergarten, a grade school, and a high school. He'd worked for a paving company, a trucking company, a shoe store, and as a driver for a florist before finding work at Milo's in East Baltimore. He'd spread his seed at least once, or so it seemed, married, divorced, remarried, and divorced again. Owned a house that he'd lost in divorce number one, rented a smaller place from then on. Over the course of his life, he'd owned 9 cars, 3 motorcycles, and 1 dog. Died in the same town where he was born. 54 years on this earth, and, to the best of anyone's recollection, he'd expected little of others and gave about the same in return. Wasn't an angry man, though most got the sense it would be foolish to push him. Wasn't a happy man, though he liked a good joke when he heard it. Someday, all who had reason to remember him would pass from the earth. Judging by what Rachel had seen of the ways people looked after their health in Lee's circle of friends and acquaintances, that someday would come sooner rather than later. Then the only person who would know his name would be whoever mowed the grass near his headstone. "He didn't live his life," her mother would have said. "It lived him." And in that moment, Rachel realized why her mother had probably never told Lee about her, or her about Lee. Elizabeth had seen how his life would play out. She had known his wants were small, his imagination limited, his ambitions nebulous. Elizabeth Childs, who'd grown up in a small town and chosen to live in a small town, had despised small-town thinking. Her mother had never told Rachel who her father was, because to admit she'd given her body to him in the first place would have been to admit that some part of her had never wanted to escape where she'd come from. "So instead," Rachel thought, "you robbed us of each other." Rachel sat at his grave for the better part of an hour. She waited to hear his voice in the wind or the trees. And it came. It actually came. But it wasn't pretty.
"You want someone to tell you why?"
"Yes."
"Why there's pain and loss? Why earthquakes and hunger? But mostly, why no one gives a shit about you, Rachel?"
"Stop," she was pretty sure she said aloud.
"You know what the answer is.
Just stop."
"Because."
"Because what?" she said to the quiet of the cemetery.
"Because nothing. Just because."
She lowered her head and didn't weep, didn't make a sound. But for a very long time, she couldn't stop shaking.
"You've come a long way to get this answer. And here it is, at long last, right in front of your face."
She raised her head, opened her eyes, stared at it, 1.5 feet tall, 20 inches wide.
"It's granite and dirt, and there's no more to it."
She didn't leave the cemetery until the sun fell halfway down its black trees. It was close to 4 in the afternoon. She'd arrived at 10 in the morning. She never heard his voice again. Not once. On the train back north, she looked out the window, but it was night and all she could see of the cities and towns was the blur of lights and the dark in between. Most of the time she couldn't see anything at all out there, just her own reflection, just Rachel, still alone. Still on the wrong side of the mirror. 2. Brian, 2011 to 2014. Chapter 9. The Sparrow. Rachel and Brian Delacroix crossed paths again 6 months after their last email contact, in the spring, at a bar in the South End. He ended up there because it was a few blocks from his apartment, and that night, the first of the year to hint of summer, the streets smelled damp and hopeful. She went to the bar because she'd gotten divorced that afternoon and needed to feel brave. She worried her fear of people was metastasizing, and she wanted to get on top of it, to prove to herself she was in command of her own neuroses. It was May, and she'd barely left the house since early winter. She'd go out for groceries, but only when the supermarket was at its emptiest. 7 o'clock on a Tuesday morning was ideal, The pallets of shrink-wrapped stock still waiting in the middle of the aisles. The dairy guys talking smack to the deli guys. The cashiers putting their purses away and yawning into cardboard cups of Dunkin's, bitching about the commute, the weather, their impossible kids, their impossible husbands. When she needed her haircut, she always scheduled the last appointment of the day. Same for the rare manicure or pedicure. Most other wants could be satisfied online. Soon, what started as a choice, staying out of the public eye to avoid scrutiny or its bedfellow judgment, grew into a habit that bordered on addiction. Before Sebastian officially left her, he'd been sleeping in the guest room for months. Prior to that, he'd slept on his boat in the South River, a tidal flat that emptied into Massachusetts Bay. It was fitting. Sebastian had probably never loved her, probably never loved any human being, but man, he loved that boat. Once he was gone, though, her primary motivation for leaving the house, to escape him and all his toxic disregard, was neutralized. But spring hit, and she could hear voices, unhurried and pleasant, return to the street, along with the shouts of children, the clack of stroller wheels along the sidewalk, the squeak and snap of screen doors. The house she'd purchased with Sebastian was 30 miles south of Boston in Marshfield. It was a seaside town, though their house sat a full mile inland, which was fine because Rachel wasn't a fan of the ocean. Sebastian, of course, loved the sea, had even taught her to scuba dive back in the early days of their courtship. When she finally admitted to him that she hated being submerged in liquid as potential predators watched her from the depths, instead of being flattered she'd temporarily conquered her fear to make him happy, he accused her of pretending to love the things he loved in order to trap him. She'd retorted that one only trapped things one wanted to eat, and she'd lost her appetite for him a long time ago. It was a nasty thing to say, but when a relationship collapsed with the speed and severity of hers and Sebastian's, nasty became the norm. Once the divorce was final, they would put the house on the market and split any profit to be had, and she'd need to find another place. Which was fine. She missed the city, had never taken to having to drive everywhere. And if her notoriety was difficult to escape in the city, it was impossible in a small town, where gazes came steeped in gradations of provincialism. Just a couple of weeks back, she'd been caught out in the open while pumping gas. She hadn't realized until she pulled in with a bone-dry tank that the station was self-serve only. Three high school girls, reality TV ready in their push-up bras, yoga pants, satiny blowouts, and diamond-cut cheekbones, exited the food mart on their way to a boy in a skin-tight thermal sweatshirt and distressed jeans who pumped gas into a pristine Lexus SUV. As soon as they noticed Rachel, the trio started whispering and shoving each other. When she looked over, one of them reddened and dropped her gaze, but the other two doubled down. The dark-haired one, with the peach highlights, mimed someone guzzling from a bottle, and her honey-blonde partner-in-bitch screwed up her features into a pantomime of helpless weeping, then wrung her hands in the air as if freeing them of seaweed. The third one said, "Guys, stop!" But it came out half-lament, half-giggle, and then the laughter broke from all their pretty, ugly mouths like Friday night Kahlua vomit. Rachel hadn't left the house since. She almost ran out of food. She did run out of wine. Then vodka. She ran out of sights to surf and shows to watch. Then Sebastian called to remind her the divorce hearing was scheduled for that Tuesday, May 17th, at 3:30. She made herself presentable and drove into the city. She realized only after she'd gotten on Route 3, heading north, that it had been 6 months since she'd driven on a highway. The other cars raced and revved and swarmed. Their bodies gleamed like knives in the harsh sunlight. They engulfed her, stabbing at the air, surging and stabbing and breaking, red taillights flashing like furious eyes. Great, Rachel thought, as the anxiety found her throat and her skin and the roots of her hair. Now I'm afraid of driving. She managed to make it into the city, and it felt like she was getting away with something because she shouldn't have been on the road, not feeling this vulnerable, this hysterical. But she made it, and no one was the wiser. She left the garage and walked across the street and appeared at the appointed time at Suffolk Probate and Family Court on New Charton Street. The proceedings were a lot like the marriage, and a lot like Sebastian, perfunctory and bloodless. After it was over, and their union was, as far as the Commonwealth was concerned, legally dissolved, she turned to share a look with her newly minted ex-husband. A look, if not of two soldiers who'd found a modicum of victory in walking off the battlefield with their limbs intact, at least one of common decency. But Sebastian wasn't across the aisle any longer. He was already halfway out of the courtroom, his back to her, head up, strides long and purposeful. And once he was through the doors, the rest of the people in the courtroom were looking at her with pity or revulsion. "That's who I've become," she thought, "a creature below contempt." Her car was parked in the garage across the street, and from there it was two right turns and a merge onto 93 South to head home. But she thought of all those cars merging and speeding, tapping their brakes and switching lanes with violent jerks of the wheel, and she turned west into the city instead, and drove over Beacon Hill, through Back Bay and farther on until she reached the South End. She felt okay during the drive. Only once, when she thought a Nissan was going to pass her on the right as she approached an intersection, did her palms sweat. After a few minutes of driving around, she found the rarest of all things for this neighborhood, a parking spot, and pulled into it. She sat there and reminded herself to breathe. She waved on two cars that mistook her for someone who was about to depart, not someone who'd just arrived.
"Turn off your fucking engine, then!"
the driver of the second car yelled, and left a burnt rubber vapor in his wake that smelled like a smoker's burp. She left her car and wandered the neighborhood, not entirely aimless but close, remembering that somewhere around here was a bar where she'd once spent a happy night. That was when she was still in print journalism with the Globe. Rumors had circulated that the series she'd written on the Mary Ellen McCormick housing project might be nominated for a Pulitzer. It wasn't, though she did win the Horace Greeley Award and the Penn Winship for Excellence in Investigative Journalism, but she didn't care in the end. She knew she'd done good work, and back then, that was enough. It was an old man bar with a red door called Keneally's Tap, tucked on one of the last ungentrified blocks in the neighborhood, if she remembered correctly. The name itself a throwback to a time before all Irish bars had to sound vaguely literary, like St. James's Gate, Elysian Fields, the Isle of Statues. She eventually found the red door on a block she hadn't initially recognized because its Toyotas and Volvos had been replaced with Benzes and Range Rover Sports, and the functional bars on the windows had been replaced by filigreed ones with more substantial aesthetic appeal. Keneally's was still there, but its menu was posted out front now, and they'd gotten rid of the mozzarella sticks and the deep-fried chicken poppers and replaced them with pork cheeks and braised kale. She walked straight to a free chair in the far corner near the waitstaff station, and when the bartender found her, she ordered a vodka rocks and asked if he had the day's paper lying around. She wore a gray hoodie over a white V-neck T-shirt and dark blue jeans. The flats on her feet were black, scuffed, and as forgettable as the rest of her ensemble. It didn't matter. For all the talk of progress, of equal footing, of a post-sexist generation, a woman still couldn't sit alone at a bar and have a drink without drawing stares. She kept her head down and read the Globe and sipped her vodka and tried to keep the addled sparrow in her chest from flapping its wings. The bar wasn't more than a quarter full, which was good, but the clientele was a lot younger than she'd counted on, which wasn't. The old-timers she'd expected to find had been reduced to a quartet of geezers who sat at a scarred table near the back room and slipped out for frequent smoke breaks. It had been naive to think that here, in the trendiest of all Boston neighborhoods, the shot-and-a-beer crowd could have held the line against the single malt cohort. Old-timers who embraced day-drinking and swilled PBRs and Gansett tall boys without an irony chaser rarely watched the 6 o'clock news. The younger crowd didn't watch it either, at least not in real time, but they might DVR it or stream it through their laptops later. And they certainly accessed YouTube on a regular basis. When the clip of Rachel's meltdown went viral last fall, there were 80,000 hits in the first 12 hours. Within 24, there were 7 memes and a video mashup of Rachel blinking, sweating, stuttering, and hyperventilating, backed by a remix of Beyoncé's Drunk in Love. That's how it had played out. A drunk reporter loses control during a live report from a Port-au-Prince ghetto. Within 36 hours of the incident, the video had 270,000 hits. Her few friends told Rachel she likely overestimated the number of people who recognized her in public. They assured her that the very nature of the viral age, its need for constant replenishment of content, ensured that the video, while watched by many, was remembered by few. It was fair to assume, however, that half the people in the bar under 35 had seen it. They may have been stoned or drunk at the time, which raised the possibility they'd see the single woman at the bar in the baseball cap reading the newspaper and make no connection. But then again, maybe a few of them had been sober and possessed strong memories. With a few swift upticks of her gaze, she got a sense of the other people at the bar itself. Two office women sipping martinis with an added splash of something pink. Five male brokers who pounded beers and fist-bumped over whatever game was on the TV above them. A mixed-sex group of techies in their late 20s who managed to keep their shoulders hunched even when they drank. And a well-dressed and well-groomed couple in their early 30s. The male clearly drunk, the woman clearly disgusted and a little afraid. Those two were the nearest to Rachel, four seats to her right, and at one point one of those seats half toppled into another two, the front pair of legs rising off the floor. The woman said, "Jesus, enough!" And it was in her voice, as it had been in her eyes, the fear and disgust. When the guy said, "Fucking calm yourself, you spoiled fucking..." Rachel accidentally caught his eye, then his girlfriend's, and they all pretended it didn't happen as he righted the chair. She neared the end of her drink and decided this had been a bad idea. Her fear of particular people, i.e. people who'd seen her have an unrestrained panic attack on the 6 o'clock news, had blinded her to her terror of people in general, an ever-burgeoning phobia she was only now beginning to suspect the breadth of. She should have run back to the house after court. She never should have sat in a bar. Jesus. The sparrow flapped its wings. Not too spastically, not frantically, not yet. But the tempo was increasing. She was aware of her heart dangling in her chest, suspended from cords of blood. The eyes of the bar were on her, and in the garble of a group of voices behind her, she was nearly positive she heard someone whisper, "That reporter." She put a $10 bill on the bar, relieved she had one, because she couldn't imagine waiting for change, couldn't sit in this seat a second longer. Her throat closed, her vision blurred at the edges. The air looked as if it had been smelted. She went to stand, but the bartender placed a drink in front of her.
"A gentleman sent this over with his respect."
The group of suit-clad guys across the bar watched the game. They gave off a former frat boy rapist vibe. Early to mid-30s, the five of them, two going fleshy, all with eyes that were too small and too bright at the same time. The tallest of them gave her a chin tilt of recognition and raised his glass. She said to the bartender, "Him?" The bartender looked over his shoulder.
"No, not the group, another guy."
He scanned the bar.
"He must have hit the head."
"Well, tell him thank you, but..."
Shit.
Now the drunken boyfriend who'd knocked over the chair was approaching, pointing at her like he was a game show host and she'd just won a dinette set. His disgusted and frightened girlfriend was nowhere to be seen. The closer he got, the less good-looking he was. It wasn't that he wasn't fit or didn't have a luxurious tousal of dark hair and full lips draped over a white, wholesome smile, or that he didn't move with a certain style, because all of that was part of the package. As are the eyes, as rich and brown as English toffee, but oh my, Rachel, what lies behind them, what lies in them, is cruelty. Self-impressed, unreflective cruelty. You have seen this look before. In Felix Browner. In Josué Dasleu. In projects and high-rises. In self-satisfied predators.
"Hey, sorry about that."
"About what?"
"My girlfriend. My now ex-girlfriend, and that's been a long time coming. She's got a thing for drama. Everything's drama."
"I think she was just worried you'd had too much to drink." "Why are you even talking, Rachel? Walk away." He opened his arms wide.
Some people, when they have an extra one or two, they get mean, you know? That's a problem, drunk. Me? I get happy. I'm just a happy guy looking to make friends and have a fun night. I don't see how that can be a problem.
Well, good luck. He pointed at her drink.
You gotta finish that. Be a crime to let it go to waste.
He held out his hand.
I'm Landa.
Actually, I'm good. He dropped his hand and turned his head to the bartender.
A Patron Silva, my good man.
He turned back to her.
Why were you watching us?
I wasn't watching you. The bartender brought his drink. He took a sip.
But you were. I caught your eye.
You guys were getting a little loud, and I looked up.
We were loud? He smirked.
Yes.
Offended your sense of propriety, did it?
No. She didn't correct his malapropism, but she did fail to stifle a sigh.
Am I boring you?
No, you seem like a nice guy, but I've got to go. He gave her a big, friendly smile.
No, you don't. Have that drink.
The bird was starting to flap hard now, its head and beak rising to the base of her throat. I'm going to go. Thank you. She slung her bag over her shoulder.
He said, You're the woman on the news.
She didn't feel like living through the 5 or 10 minutes it would take to deny it, and then re-deny it, and then ultimately give him his due, and yet she still played dumb. What woman?
The one who flipped out.
He glanced at the drink in front of her that she still hadn't touched.
Were you drunk? Or high? Which was it? Come on, you can tell me.
She gave him a tight smile and went to move past him. Lander said,
Hey, hey, hey,
and put his chest between her and the door.
I just want to know.
He took one step back and squinted at her.
Just want to know what you were thinking. I mean, I want to be friends.
I'd like to go. She gestured with her right hand for him to step aside. He reared his head back, curled his lower lip, and mimicked her gesture.
I'm just asking a question. People put their trust in you.
He tapped a single finger off her shoulder.
I know, I know, I know. You think I'm drunk, and maybe, you know, maybe I am. But what I'm saying is important. I'm a fun guy. I'm a nice guy. My friends think I'm hilarious. I got 3 sisters. Thing is, point is here, that you think, like, it's okay to start throwing back the sauce on the job because you probably got a net to land in if it backfires. Am I right? Some doctor or venture capitalist hubby who...
He lost the thought, then caught it again, splayed his pink fingers against the base of his pink throat.
I can't do that. I gotta go make the money. I bet you got some sugar daddy pays for your Pilates and your Lex and the lunches where you hang with your homegirls and shit all over everything he does for you. Have that drink, bitch. Somebody bought it for you. Show some respect.
He wavered in front of her. She wondered what she'd do if he touched her shoulder again. Nobody was moving in the bar. No one was saying anything. No one was trying to help. They were all just watching the show. I'd like to go, she repeated, and took a step toward the door. He put that single finger on her shoulder again.
One more minute. Have a drink with me. With us.
He waved at the bar.
Don't make us feel like you think bad of me. You don't think bad of me, right? I'm just a guy in the street. I'm just a regular dude. I'm just... Rachel.
Brian Delacroix materialized by Lander's left shoulder, slid past his hip, and was suddenly standing beside her.
I'm so sorry. I got hung up.
He gave Lander a distant smile before turning back to her.
Look, we're late. I'm sorry. Doors were at 8. We gotta go.
He took her vodka off the bar and downed it in one easy swallow. Brian wore a navy blue suit, white shirt with the top button undone, black tie loosened and slightly askew. He remained quite handsome, but not in the way that made you think he'd hold up the bathroom every morning. His look was more rugged, his face just on the right side of craggy, his smile a bit crooked, his wavy black hair not fully tamed. Weathered skin, crow's feet around the eyes, strong chin and nose. His blue eyes were open and amused, as if he were perpetually surprised to find himself in situations such as these.
"You look spectacular, by the way," he said. "Again, sorry I got held up. No excuse."
"Whoa, whoa."
Lander squinted at his own drink for a moment.
"Okay?"
This could easily be a scam perpetuated by the both of them. Lander played the wolf, she was the unwitting sheep, and the part of the shepherd was played by Brian Delacroix. She hadn't forgotten that weird vibe he'd given off that day at the Athenaeum, and found their just happening to find each other on the day of her divorce a bit too coincidental. She decided not to play along. She held up her hands.
"Guys, I think I'm just gonna..."
But Lander didn't hear her because he pushed Brian.
"Yo, bro, you need to step off."
Brian gave her an amused cock of the eyebrow when Lander called him bro. She had to work at it to keep her own smile from breaking out. He turned to Lander.
"Dude, I would, but I can't. I know, you're disappointed, but hey, you didn't know she was waiting on me. You're a fun guy, though, I can tell, and the night's young."
He indicated the bartender.
"Tom knows me. Right, Tom?"
Tom said, "I do indeed."
"So, what's your name?"
"Landa."
"Cool name.
Thanks."
"Honey," he said to Rachel, "why don't you pull the car around?"
Rachel heard herself say, "Sure."
"Lander,"
he said, but he met Rachel's eyes and flicked his own toward the door.
"Your money's no good here tonight. Whatever you imbibe, Tom will put it on my tab."
He flicked his eyes at her again, a little bit more insistently, and this time she moved.
"You want to buy a round for those girls over there by the pool table? That's on me, too. The one in the green flannel and the black jeans has been looking at you since I came through the door."
She made the door and didn't glance back, though she wanted to. But the last look she'd caught on Lander's face was of a dog waiting, head cocked, for either a treat or a command. In under a minute, Brian Delacroix had taken ownership of him. She couldn't find her car. She walked block after block. She cut east, then west, turned north, retraced her steps south. Somewhere in this collection of wrought iron fences and railings and chocolate or red brick townhouses was a light gray 2010 Prius. It was Brian's voice, she decided, as she headed up a side street toward the lights of Copley Square. It was warm, confident, and smooth, but not huckster smooth. It was the voice of a friend you'd been hoping to meet your whole life, or a caring uncle who'd left your life too soon but had now returned. It was the voice of home, but not home the reality, home as a construct, home as an ideal. A few minutes later, that voice entered the air behind her.
"I won't take it personally if you think I'm a stalker and pick up your pace. I won't. I'll stay planted to this spot and never see you again."
She stopped, turned, saw him standing back at the mouth of the alley she'd crossed 30 seconds before. He stood under the streetlight with his hands clasped in front of him, and he didn't move. He'd added a raincoat over the suit.
"But if you're open to a little more of the evening, I'll stay 10 paces back and follow you wherever you'll let me buy you a drink."
She looked at him for a long time, long enough for her to notice that the sparrow had stopped flapping in her chest, and the base of her throat had come unblocked. She felt as calm as she'd felt since she was last safe behind closed doors in her own home. "Make it 5 paces," she said. Chapter 10 Lights Up. They walked through the south end, and soon she realized why he wore the raincoat. There was a mist in the air so thin she didn't notice it until her hair was damp and her forehead was wet. She raised her hood above her head, but of course it was damp now, too. "Did you send over the vodka?"
"I did."
"Why?"
"Honestly?"
"No, inauthentically." He chuckled.
"Because I had to use the bathroom, and I wanted to make sure you'd still be there when I got out."
"Why not just walk up to me?"
"Nerves. It's not like you've seemed elated the times I've initiated contact over the years."
She slowed then, and he caught up. "I did like getting your emails," she said.
"Odd. You didn't respond like it."
"It's been a complicated decade for me," She gave him a smile that felt hesitant but hopeful. He removed his raincoat and draped it over her shoulders.
"I'm not taking your coat," she said.
"I know you're not. I'm lending it to you."
"I don't need it."
He stepped back, got a look at her.
"Fine. Give it back."
She smiled, rolled her eyes. "Well, if you insist." They walked on, their footsteps the only sound for a full block.
"Where are you taking us?"
he said.
"I was hoping the RR still exists."
"It does. One block up, two over."
She nodded. "Why do they call it that? There are no tracks near it."
"The Underground Railroad. They used to run most of the slaves out through that block. This building here?"
He pointed at a red brick mansion tucked between a row house and what had once been a church.
"Was where Edgar Ross set up the first black-run printing press in the early 1800s.
She shot him a sidelong glance.
"Aren't we a font? I like history."
He gave her a shrug that was somehow cute on a big man.
"Left here."
They turned left. The street was older and quieter. A lot of the garages or garage apartments had been livery stables at one time. The windows were thick and leaded. The trees looked as old as the Constitution.
"I liked your hard news stories better than the soft ones, by the way."
She chuckled. "You didn't feel sufficiently informed when I did that story on the cat that barked?" He snapped his fingers.
"Promise me it's archived."
They heard a metallic pop, and the street turned black. Every light, in the houses, in the street lamps, in the small office building at the end of the street, snapped off. They could see each other, if barely, in the pewter gloaming cast by the tall buildings that fringed the neighborhood, but this near dark was alien, and carried with it the arrival of the postponable truth that all urban dwellers kept tucked on high shelves. We are unprepared for most forms of survival, at least those that don't come with amenities. They continued up the street with a bit of wonder. The hairs on her skin were alive in a way they hadn't been 5 minutes ago. Her hearing was sharper. All her pores were wide open. Her scalp was cold, damp, adrenalized. Haiti had felt like this. Port-au-Prince, Laogan, Jacmel. In some neighborhoods, they were still waiting for the lights to come back on. A woman stepped out of a building on the corner. She held a candle in one hand and a flashlight in the other, and as she swept the flashlight across their torsos, Rachel made out the sign above her head and realized they were at the RR bar.
"Oh, hey!"
The woman waved the flashlight up and down, and the light anointed them before rejoining their bodies at the knees.
"What are you two doing out in this?"
"Looking for her car," he said. "Then we just decided to look for your bar, then this happened."
He raised his hands to the dark, and there was another metallic groan, and the lights came back on. They blinked into the soft shafts of neon cast by the beer sign in the window and the bar sign above the door.
"Nice trick," the bartender said. "You do birthday parties?"
She opened the door for them, and they went inside. It was as Rachel remembered, maybe even better. The lights a little lower, the smell of old beer soaked into black rubber, replaced with the faintest hint of hickory. Tom Waits on the jukebox when they came through the door, fading as they ordered their drinks, and replaced by Radiohead from the Pablo Honey era. Tom Waits she could place in his proper context because most of his best music predated her, but it was often a shock, however predictable, however mild, to realize there were people legally drinking in bars who'd been in diapers when Radiohead was part of her college years soundtrack. "We age as the rest of the world watches," she thought, "but somehow we are the last to know." There was no one else in the bar but them and Gail, the bartender. Halfway through their first drinks, Rachel said to Brian, "Tell me about the last time I saw you." His eyes narrowed in confusion. "You were with an antiquities dealer." He snapped his fingers.
"Jack Ahern, right? Was that Jack?"
"It was."
"We were heading to lunch. Ran into you up at the top of Beacon Hill."
"Yes, yes," she said. "Those are the facts. But I'm after the vibe."
"You were off that day, my man. Couldn't get rid of me quick enough."
He was nodding.
"Yeah, sorry about that."
"You admit it?"
"Hell yeah."
He turned on his seat, choosing his words. Jack was an investor in a small subsidiary I was creating at the time. Nothing big, just a company that makes high-end wood floors and shutters. Jack's also a self-appointed moralist, very 15th century in that regard. Lutheran fundamentalist or Calvinist fundamentalist, I can't remember which. I get them confused, too. He shot her a wry grin. Anyway, I was married then. She took a long pull on her drink.
Married?
Yeah. Heading for a divorce, but married in that moment. And I'm a salesman. I was selling that marriage to my moralistic client.
I'm with you so far.
Then I see you crossing the street toward me, and I know if I don't get ahead of it, he's gonna see it, so I got all hyper, like I do when I'm really nervous, and I bungled the whole fucking thing.
You said, get ahead of it. What's it?
He cocked his head, and then his eyebrow at her.
Do I really have to say the words?
It's your explanation, my friend.
It would be my attraction to you, Rachel. My ex used to get on me about it.
Are you watching your girlfriend on the news again?
My friends could see it. I'm damn sure Jack Ahern would have picked up on it if my tongue was hanging out in the middle of Beacon Street. I mean, Jesus, ever since Chicopee. Come on.
You come on. I didn't know about this.
Oh, well, yeah. I guess, why would you?
You could have mentioned it.
In an email? That you'd be reading with that picture-perfect husband of yours?
He was anything but.
I didn't know that at the time. Plus, I was married.
What happened to her?
She left, went back to Canada.
So we're both divorced. He nodded and raised his glass.
To that.
She clinked his glass, drained her own, and they ordered two more.
She said, tell me something you don't like about yourself.
I don't like? I thought the point was to show off your best self in the early going.
The early going of what?
Meeting someone.
Dating? Are we calling this a date?
I hadn't thought of it that way yet.
You've got your drink, I've got mine. We're turned toward each other, trying to ascertain if we enjoy each other's company enough to do it again.
That does sound like a date.
He held up a finger.
Unless it's like an NFL preseason game to a date.
MLB spring training to a date, she said. Wait, what do they call the preseason in the NBA?
The preseason.
Oh, I know, but what do they call it?
That's what they call it.
You sure? Seems unoriginal.
And yet, there it is.
And how about the NHL?
Fuck if I know.
But you're Canadian.
Yes, he admitted, but I'm not very good at it.
They both laughed for no other reason but that her mother's first stage, the spark, had been reached. Somewhere from the walk along the cobblestones on a block so quiet the only sounds were the echoes of their footsteps, to the smell of his damp raincoat collar under her chin, to the two-minute blackout, to the birthing of them as a duo as they crossed the threshold into the bar and Tom Waits growled softly through a fading chorus to right now, bantering over a vodka and a scotch respectively, they'd crossed a second threshold, leaving behind who they'd been before their attraction had been certified mutual, and moving forward with that attraction taken as a given.
What don't I like about myself?
She nodded. He lifted his drink and rattled the cube softly from one side of the glass to the other. The playfulness left his face and was replaced by something sad and bewildered, though not bitter. She liked that lack of bitterness immediately. She'd grown up in a house of bitterness, and then, when she was sure it would never touch her again, she married it. She'd had her fill.
Brian said, "You know when you're a kid and you don't get picked for the team? Or someone you like doesn't like you back? Or your parents reject or marginalize you not because of something you did, but because they were fucked up and toxic?"
"Yes, and yes, and yes. I can't wait to see where you're going with this."
Now he took a drink.
"I think of those times, and there are lots of them in a childhood. They accrue. And I realize that I always believed to my core that they were right. I wasn't worthy of the team. I wasn't fit to be liked back. My family rejected me because I deserved to be rejected."
He put his glass on the bar.
What I don't like about myself is that sometimes I don't really like myself.
And no matter how much good you do, she said, no matter how great a friend you are, how great a wife or husband, how great a humanitarian, nothing, I mean nothing.
Nothing,
he said, will ever make up for what a piece of shit you really are. He gave her a broad and beautiful smile.
I see you've spent time in my head.
Huh, she shook her head. Just mine. They said nothing for a minute. They finished their drinks, ordered two more. And yet, she said, you project confidence amazingly well. You handled that D-bag in the bar like you were his hypnotist.
He was an idiot. Idiots are easy to outwit. That's why they're idiots.
How do I know you weren't in on it together?
In on what?
You know, she said. He makes me feel scared, you come to my rescue.
But I got you out of there and I stayed behind.
If he was in on it with you, you could have been out that door 5 seconds after me and followed me. He opened his mouth and then closed it. He nodded.
That's a good point. Are you often approached this elaborately?
Not that I know of.
It would take an awful lot of work on my part. Wasn't that guy with a girlfriend at one point? They were fighting?
She nodded.
So I would have had to, let me order this correctly, known you were coming to the bar tonight, hired a friend to pretend he was there with a girlfriend, start a fight with her, get her to leave, then approach you and be belligerent, all so I could step in and buy you the time you needed to leave so I could then...
Okay, okay.
Run across the bar the moment you left it, slip out the door behind you, and follow you through the city on empty, quiet streets in hard-heeled shoes.
Okay, I said, okay. She gestured at his suit, his white shirt, his handsome raincoat. You're just very put together, so I'm trying to wrap my head around the part where you don't really like yourself, because you, my friend, exude confidence.
In a dickish way?
Actually, no. She shook her head.
Most times I am confident, he said. The rational adult me, he's got his shit squared away. There's just this tiny splinter me that can be accessed at midnight in a dark bar by a woman who asks what I don't like about myself.
He turned fully toward her again and waited.
Speaking of which...
She cleared her throat because for a moment she feared she'd tear up. She could feel it threatening, and it was embarrassing. She'd covered a 7.0 magnitude earthquake on an island already racked by poverty beyond most humans' ability to imagine. She'd spent a month in a housing project, walking solely on her knees in order to duplicate the perspective of a child in the same circumstances. She once climbed to the canopy of a tree 200 feet above the ground in the Brazilian rainforest and slept there overnight. And today... She'd barely managed to drive 30 miles from the suburbs to the city without cracking up. I got divorced today, she said. I lost my job, no, correct that, my career, 6 months ago, as you well know, because I had a panic attack on the air. I've grown terrified of people, not particular people, but in general, which is worse. I spent the last few months a virtual shut-in, and honestly, I can't wait to get back to it. Brian... There's nothing I like about myself. He said nothing for a minute, just looked at her. It wasn't an intense stare, didn't feel like a come-on or a challenge. It was an open look, forgiving, uncolored by judgment. It was impossible for her to characterize until she realized it was the look of a friend. She noticed the song then. It had been playing for maybe half a minute. Lenny Welch, one of the earliest but most enduring one-hit wonders, singing... Since I fell for you. Brian's head was cocked to it, his gaze gone to another place.
This played on the radio once when I was a kid at this lake we'd go to. All the adults were funny that day, a blast to be around. Took me years to realize they were all high. I couldn't understand why they kept sharing the same cigarette. Anyway, they danced by the lake to this, a bunch of stoned Canucks in nylon bathing suits.
Where did it come from, what she said next? Could that impulse be traced, or was it simply chemical? Neurons firing away, biology trumping intellect. Wanna dance?
Love to.
He took her hand, and they found the small dance floor just past the bar itself, in a dark room, lit only by the glow of the jukebox. Their first dance, then. The first time their palms and chests touched. The first time she was close enough to smell what she would always identify as Brian's essential smell, a hint of smoke entwined with the smell of his unscented shampoo and a vaguely woodsy musk to his flesh.
I sent you the drink because I didn't want you to leave the bar.
Because you had to go to the bathroom, I know.
No, I went to the bathroom because right after I sent the drink, I freaked out. I just didn't want to see you look at me like some fucking stalker. So I went to the bathroom to, I don't know, cringe. I just went in there and stood with my back against the wall and called myself stupid about 10 times.
You did not.
I did, I swear. When I used to watch you on the news, you were honest. You didn't editorialize, you didn't wink at the camera or wear your biases on your sleeve. I trusted what you said. You did your job with integrity, and that came through.
Even with the cat that barked. His face grew serious, though his tone remained light.
Don't minimize what I'm saying about you. I go through a day, sometimes a week, where everyone lies to me, everyone's trying to play me. From the car salesman to the vendors, from my doctor trying to upsell me drugs because he's trying to fuck the pharmaceutical rep, to the airlines and the hotels and the women in the hotel bars. I would get back from a trip, and I would turn on Channel 6, and you wouldn't lie to me. That meant something. Some days, particularly after my marriage blew up and I was alone all the time, that meant everything.
She didn't know what to say. She was unaccustomed to compliments lately, and unfamiliar with trust.
Thanks, she managed, and looked at the floor. This is one sad song, he said after a bit.
It is.
You want to stop?
No. She loved the press of his palm at the small of her back. It made her feel like she'd never fall, never be hurt, never lose, never be abandoned again. No, let's keep going. Chapter 11. Appetites. The beginning of their love affair injected her with a false sense of calm. She almost convinced herself the panic attacks were a thing of the past, even though their most recent onset had been the most acute. Her and Brian's first official date was a cup of coffee the morning after they met. Too buzzed to drive the night before, Rachel had splurged on a Riverview room at the Westin Copley Square. It had been over a year since she'd stayed in a hotel. In the elevator, she'd imagined ordering a snack from room service and watching a movie on demand, but she fell asleep somewhere between kicking off her shoes and pulling back the bedspread. At 10 the next morning, she met Brian at Stephanie's on Newbury. Tendrils of vodka still shivered in her blood and in the mild gumminess of her brain. Brian, on the other hand, looked great. He was actually better looking in daylight than in bar light. She asked him about his job, and he told her it paid the bills, and let him indulge his love of travel.
There's got to be more to it than that. Not actually, he chuckled. Here's what I do, day in, day out. I negotiate terms with lumber suppliers based on whether there's a lot of lumber this month or a little. Was there a drought in Australia, or did the rainy season last too long in the Philippines? Those factors change the price of lumber, which changes the price of... Oh, where do we start? That napkin, this tablecloth, that sugar packet. I'm falling asleep talking about it.
He took a sip of coffee.
What about you?
Me?
Yeah. Will you ever go back to journalism?
I doubt anyone would hire me.
If they would. Say someone who never saw that video.
And where would I find them?
I hear Chad has terrible internet service.
Chad?
Chad.
She said, well, if I can ever get on a plane again, I'll take a run at the news stations in...
In Jemena.
Capital of Chad, yes.
On the tip of your tongue, I'm sure.
It was.
No, I know.
I would have gotten it.
I'm not arguing.
Not with your mouth, maybe, she said, but with your eyes.
Yours are remarkable, by the way.
My eyes.
And your mouth.
You can hang with me anytime.
That's the plan.
His face grew a bit somber.
Did you ever think you might not have to go as far as Chad?
What do you mean?
I wonder if you're as recognizable as you think.
She cocked an eyebrow at him. I was on the news 5 nights a week in this city for almost 3 years.
You were, he said, but what's the viewership? About 5% of a city of 2 million? So that's 100,000 people, spread out over however many square miles make up the greater metro area. I bet if you polled everyone in this restaurant, only one or two would recognize you, and maybe only because we asked and made them take a second look.
She said, I can't decide if you're trying to make me feel better or worse.
Better, he said. Always better. I'm trying to get you to see, Rachel, that, yeah, a few people remember that video, and a smaller percentage of those connect it to you when they see you out in public, but it's a shrinking demographic, and it shrinks further every day. We live in a world of disposable memory. Nothing's built to last, not even shame.
She crinkled her nose at him. You talk pretty.
You are pretty.
Aw. Second date was a dinner on the South Shore near her place. Third date was back in Boston, another dinner, and afterward they made out like high school kids, her back against a lamp pole. It started to rain, not the soft mist of the night they'd met, but a pelting that coincided with a plummet into raw cold, as if winter was taking one last desperate bite out of them.
Let's get you to your car.
He tucked her under his raincoat. She could hear the drops hitting the outside of the coat like small stones, but everything remained dry except her ankles. They passed a small park where a homeless man lay on a bench. He stared out at the street as if he were trying to spot something he'd lost there. He'd covered himself in newspaper, but his head shook persistently in the wet. His lips quivered.
It's a mean spring,
the man said.
And almost June, too,
Brian said. Supposed to be clear by midnight. Rachel felt anxious and guilty about owning a bed, a car, a roof. The man gave that news a hopeful pursing of his lips and closed his eyes. In her car, she got the heat turned on and rubbed her hands together. Brian leaned into the open window for a short kiss that turned into a long one, and the rain battered her roof. Let me drive you home, she said.
It's 10 blocks in the wrong direction. The coat'll keep me dry.
You don't have a hat.
Ye of little faith.
He stepped back from the car and produced a Blue Jays ball cap from his coat pocket. When he put it on, he curved the bill with a snap of his fingers and saluted her with a cocked grin.
Drive careful. Call me when you get home.
One more. She crooked a finger at him. He leaned into the car one more time, kissed her, and she could smell the faintest hint of sweat from the underside of his cap brim and taste scotch on his tongue, and she pulled hard on the lapels of his coat and deepened the kiss. He walked back the way they'd come. She turned on her wipers and went to pull away from the curb, but her windows had fogged up. She turned on the defrost and sat watching the glass clear before she pulled onto the street. At the next corner, she was about to turn right, when she looked to her left and saw Brian. He stood in the small park. He'd removed his coat to lay it over the homeless man. He stepped out of the park, turning his shirt collar up against the rain, and ran up the street toward his home. Her mother, of course, had a whole chapter devoted to what Rachel had just witnessed, the act that causes the leap. Their fourth date, he made dinner at his apartment. While he was loading the dishwasher, she removed her t-shirt and bra and came to him in the kitchen wearing nothing but a pair of tattered boyfriend jeans. He turned just as she reached him, and his eyes widened, and he said, "Oh." She felt in complete control, which of course she wasn't, and free enough to dictate the terms of their body's first engagement. That night they started in the kitchen but finished in his bed, started round two in the bathtub and finished on the counter between the his and hers sinks. Then went for the trifecta in the bedroom again and did surprisingly well, although there was nothing left to come out of Brian at the end but a shudder. Throughout that summer, the giving of the body went spectacularly well. The giving of everything else, however, was a slower process, particularly once the panic attacks returned. For the most part, they descended when Brian was out of town. Unfortunately, the first rule of accepting him as her boyfriend was accepting that he was out of town a lot. Most of his trips were quick two-nighters to Canada, Washington State, and Oregon, twice a year to Maine. But others, to Russia, Germany, Brazil, Nigeria, and India, took much longer. Sometimes when he was first gone, it felt good to return to herself. She didn't need to see herself in terms of being half of a couple. She'd wake up the morning after he'd left and feel